My name is Lawrence Allen.
I'm Ronald Shaw.
I'm Rahul Vora.
And this is Bad Time Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Bad Time Radio. This week we're doing another old-time radio episode, and that means we've brought back our beloved semi-regular co-host, Daniel Dowdy, and we're talking about an episode of dark fantasy called The Curse of the Neanderthal, which first aired on January 9th, 1942. And I did a little research, and I mean, horrible stuff was happening at this point because it was World War II, but it wasn't like immediately after Pearl Harbor the way the last one was. So, yeah, mostly related to Hitler doing Hitler things and then the Japanese successfully conquering Malaysia. Anyways, this is an especially... we've talked about dark fantasy a lot. They're kind of our probably favorite series because they have this combination of sort of serious affect and some of the stupidest plots you can imagine that makes for very fun listening. Notable other episodes include The Demon Tree, which I think, I can't remember what we, oh yeah, we call, the episode title is The Snowball Blue Covered in Blood. And then our second episode, A Great Airy Arm, which has the stupidest twist of anything we've ever done. That was of Spawn, an episode covering Spawn of the Subhuman.
Even call it a twist, really.
I think that the fact that the gorilla could fly a plane and sing opera was pretty fucking
That wasn't
surprising.
The twist, though.
The twist was that it got replaced by a gorilla. It was just astonishing.
I do love that we have a gorilla with his pilot's license, and that's not the twist.
Well, I mean, that was kind of the twist, but the twist seemed to be that the gorilla replaced the pilot. And then, past that, the gorilla is an opera singer. That's like the main plot of the episode.
And I know you're thinking, oh, it's an Island of Dr. Moreau thing where they like turned a man into a gorilla. No, they did a little surgery to give the gorilla human vocal cords, I guess. But it is mostly just that they trained a gorilla to sing opera.
Truly, truly our forest brothers. They're so close to us.
Yeah. Anyways.
They wish they could sing opera, if only they could have the surgery.
A surprisingly simple operation that you could do in the 1940s is all it takes.
Doctors hate this one trick.
And then the other thing was that the doctor's reason for doing this was just that he wanted to manage a novelty opera act made up of gorillas.
That used to really, you could get really rich doing that back in the 40s, you know?
Yeah, those thousands of dollars.
Adjusting for inflation, that is a lot of money. Anyways,
yeah, you're pulling mid four figures.
Anyways, enough of remembering old episodes. What did we think of this episode? I'll go first. I thought it was pretty fucking funny. It didn't really seem to know what it was doing for most of the time. And it also didn't seem to really understand where it was taking place. And some of the dialogue is some of the stupidest shit I've ever heard. So all in all, you should check this out. Dan, what do you think?
I would concur. This was a hoot and a half. Just really in that sweet spot of being stupid enough that you enjoy it on the sort of Mystery Science Theater level, but not so stupid as to be like really tedious or whatever. Because this thing really did like... It kept my attention, not necessarily through great performances or anything like that, but just I was waiting for the next, what? And it really delivered. It really delivered that. So I would also recommend.
It turns into like a different radio play every like 5 minutes, which is weird.
Yes, yes. Very odd. A very strange relationship to like, to time, like when things are happening. It's a great experience.
Oh, okay. Rahul, what did you make of this?
Yeah, I recommend it, actually. Maybe I was just in a good mood when I listened to it, but I won't say the plot's good, but I enjoyed it.
I like that Russell's here with the American Bandstand. Well, I had a good beat and I could dance to it.
Yeah, pretty much.
And Ronald, what did you think of this preposterous concoction?
I mean, I had a good time with it, I guess, but I don't really recommend it because it's incredibly stupid and basically a waste of your time. It does have some really absurd stuff that's like, wow, that's really funny how stupid that is. So I guess if that's what you're looking for, this is definitely a pretty good one. But if you actually want to listen to like good old time radio, this is not it.
Okay, and let's go ahead and roll for the summary. Is there anyone who doesn't want to be included? Okay, I take your silence as consent. This is the don't only situation where that's acceptable, incidentally.
Right.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to... Me, 1-2, Ronald, 3-4, Dan, 5-6, and the Neanderthal, which is what Rahul has called himself, will be 7-8.
Oh, no, the Neanderthal.
It's Dan.
All right.
Oh, shit.
Dan's okay. Summary.
I'm good. This is, you know, I think I can hack it.
I don't know. You're human, though. Can you really do a Neanderthal story justice with your human DNA?
I will say that there is some evidence that folks with ginger hair have the greatest percentage of Neanderthal DNA. So,
ooh.
Well, there you go.
I might be just the guy.
There's but a Neanderthal among us.
Now, Dan, I don't want to like spotlight you too much, but I've seen some photos of you, and you appear to no longer have ginger hair, though. So,
I have a ginger beard, at least, and historically, I had ginger hair. I do still have a prominent brow ridge, though. They can't take that from me.
And you are, of course, well over 8 feet tall. And I'm pretty sure when you die, you're going to turn into a swarf.
I'm going to turn into a Smurf. Exactly.
I'll give you a countdown. And then
Dan might already be a Swarf. I'm not sure, honestly.
Yeah, we've never seen him. So we don't know if he changes shape or not.
I have no clue. Right.
Yeah, anyways, I'm going to do a countdown, then everyone mute, and I'll do the timer. So 3, 2, 1.
Okay, so we open with a couple of men being very dismissive toward a woman who's very concerned and trying to call her sister. They are all at an artist colony somewhere. It's unclear, but it's somewhere where on the property there is a canyon accessible only via one of two entrances at either end of the canyon. The woman is trying to get her sister in London on the line, and she ends up explaining through a kind of flashback to these men, one of whom is her partner, that she had gone to paint a landscape in the canyon, and when she was down there, there was a landslide which blocked her path, and as she was trying to find a way out of the canyon, an apparition of her sister appeared, pointing her in a direction to get out of the canyon. After that, they look at her painting a little closer, and there was some sort of strange brutish figure that she managed to capture with her, I guess, automatic painting without realizing what she was painting. And they decide to investigate that spot where she painted that figure, and they find a fissure with some human bones, some human remains of a giant proportions, 8-foot proportions. And there's a visiting paleoanthropologist, apparently, at the artist colony, so they call him out to take a look, where he finds a tablet which has a Neanderthal curse, cursing anyone who moves the bones. They conjecture that the apparition the woman saw was a swarf, which is some kind of spirit who can take the form of any kind of human being that it wants to. So the professor removes the bones to take them to the museum to mount them as a skeletal mount, because that's what you do. And when the woman and her beau go to visit the professor, they're going to go see the Neanderthal setup. They go into the display room where it's supposed to be, but there's nothing there at the display. And then a mysterious hulking giant figure about 8 feet tall, they note, comes in and asks, where is Professor Whatever's office? And they point him in that direction. Then they think to themselves, hey, something's fishy about that. They go in there, they find the professor dead of a broken neck. And then they read his notes, his assessment of the remains that they removed, where he assesses that the individual represented by these remains himself died of a broken neck. And also the skeletal mount has mysteriously reappeared in that in the space and museum after they have found the doctor dead.
Dan, you were quite a bit over, but you were also on a roll and being delightful, so I didn't want to interrupt you.
Okay, cool. I did try to keep it pretty compact, but
it was summarized. I mean, you got pretty much everything in the episode.
I'm just glad you guys are here to tell the listeners that I did actually accurately summarize what we listened to, because
that is
no one
happened.
Would believe
yeah.
me. Yeah.
It sounds fantastical, but that's about, you know, I don't even really think you missed like the pacing or anything. Like,
the only thing that I know of is that they note after the Neanderthal ghost has disappeared that it apparently was holding its head very strangely.
Yes.
which also reinforces that it died of a broken neck, because you need to kind of tell the audience things twice, you know?
You really got to hammer it home with these people, because, you know, I mean, unless they know what a swarf is, they're going to be really, really lost. And I got things to say.
I didn't bother Googling swarf. It sounds pretty made up, and also the audio quality was pretty bad, so I couldn't be sure that that's what the fuck they were saying.
It's a real word, but it has nothing to do with magic.
Yeah, and the dictionary defines it as fine chips or filings of stone, metal, or other material produced by a machining process.
Oh, so it's like sawdust, but for metal.
Oh, wait, no. They were saying swarth, which is a thing. It's it's sort of a mispronunciation of a wraith, kind of.
All right.
Great.
Boy, you'd think for people like us, we would have encountered this term before.
Yeah, this is a new
one. Right?
Yeah.
Well, I probably encountered it in my earlier days when my tastes were a little bit mundane, but of course I've left things as prosaic as swarths behind in my search of truly esoteric darkness.
So, I mean, I'm just...
It's literally spelled like swarthy, but without the Y.
I was going to say S-W-O-R-T-H is also, apparently from Urban Dictionary, your sexual self-worth. They could have been talking about that.
that might be right, yeah.
It does constantly metamorphose depending on what the situation demands.
It could be. I mean, honestly, I'm just surprised that that term wasn't used for one of the many monsters I have slain in the Witcher video game series.
Hmm.
Yeah. That seems like exactly the kind of thing. Like, they just go to, like, you know, like a thesaurus for spooks and goblins. And, you know.
Yeah. Anyways, let's get into some high points. So, first off, some of the dialogue on this is like really, really, really funny to me. So here's some choice things. I'm going to try to do these in like the old time radio voice. So, you're wrong. These things do happen. Swarths do appear in that vicinity. But that's weird. And then, I've studied anatomy enough to recognize the clavicle, humerus and ulna of the human arm. That one, I legit think it's a bum line read, and he forgot that there was more to the sentence.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There was a couple of those.
Very strangely delivered, but I appreciated that, like, you know, like, and you know, he's right, the human clavicle is probably pretty diagnostic. I don't think a lot of animals would have a bone shaped that way. But boy, yeah, it makes for just a really stupid line.
And also, I mean, this guy appears to just be sort of an ambiguously wealthy, like, man of leisure, either English or American, unclear. And
yeah, the mid-Atlantic accent was all over this mamma jamma.
Yeah, so it's really weird to me that he's apparently just like trying to figure out bones. I guess that's his hobby.
He's just a bone guy.
Yeah. So he's a polymath. He's a Renaissance man, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's not, because as far as we know, he only knows one thing. Was he also the guy who knew about swarths?
He was also the swarth guy.
He was also the swarth
Okay,
guy.
So he is a polymath. He knows two things.
The other guy just seemed to be outraged by the idea that ghosts exist. Which, to be fair, I think that'd be me in this scenario.
But doesn't the other guy also, like, at one point, like, start believing in curses? These people don't seem to really, I guess.
Yeah. Which also had one of my favorite lines, which was the anthropologist guy being dismissive of the person being afraid of the curse. Like, what, you're going to move the bones? What about the curse? And then the anthropologist guy says, like, after 40,000 years? I don't think so.
He says, surely it would have faded after 40,000 years.
Right? It's like,
he doesn't find the idea that a curse exists preposterous. It just would never last that long.
Yeah, curses are real, but this is way past the expiration date. We're fine.
Yeah. Anyways,
you think a gallon of milk from that time is also going to be like totally fine to drink?
You know, it's the same thing. I think depending on storage, a gallon of milk from 40,000 years ago would have turned into a curse.
Definitely.
I mean, at the very least, it's not something you want to encounter.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone else got some high points?
I do have a high point. It's a genuine high point. So this is recorded in 1942, and our anthropologist, despite all of the shit that they get very wrong about Neanderthals, which is a lot, I guess we can get into a little more. But he makes it a point in talking about, like, you know, the other, you know, people, the artist colony people are kind of asking him questions about, you know, and Neanderthals and whatnot. And he actually goes to the trouble of explaining that they, yes, they had an appearance that would seem a bit brutish to us, with, you know, a low skull and the kind of, you know, projecting face, but that there is every evidence that their brains were as developed as, you know, as Homo sapiens as we know them, that they were very skilled tool makers and hunters, and they led fairly sophisticated lives. That's actually very fair, and I was not expecting that, because this is typically the kind of, you know, pulp milieu where you just expect the caveman stereotype to be fully trotted out and whatever. But they actually went out of their way to give a minute and a half or so of kind of dialogue of explaining that, like, no, these were real, these were human beings in much the same way that we were human beings, and they had a sophisticated way of interacting with the world. And I appreciated that.
Yeah. That said, Neanderthals were not 8 feet tall.
They were not 8 feet tall. They tended to be shorter than Homo sapiens, in fact.
And also, although it's, I mean, there's no reason they couldn't have had a written language. Absolutely no evidence of written language survives from them, or I think even humans of that period.
No, not at all. The very earliest written language that we can say with any certainty is written language. You get into kind of a turf battle between the Egyptologists and the Assyriologists over this. So it's either going to be Mesopotamia or Egypt somewhere around 4,000 to 3,000 BC.
Which makes it all the more baffling when the anthropologist somehow could just sight read a Neanderthal curse tablet. Yeah.
And it is off the dome. It is like, brother, that is not how any of this works. And he said, it's Neanderthal picture writing, which would seem to indicate, one, that there is a corpus of Neanderthal picture writing already existing that has been deciphered, and that it is apparently uniform across wherever Neanderthals are found. They all shared this particular type of pictogram writing, and that it can be fluidly translated into grammatical English sentences.
I mean, this is roughly amazing. To, like, you being able to look at, like, something in Spanish and being like, oh, this is just human picture writing, and bam, you can understand it.
Well, okay, here's the thing.
I assume you do not actually speak Spanish, of course.
You just don't get it because a Swarth told him how to do it.
Swarths exist, very well could have been. I did a little bit of Neanderthal picture reading right off the dome the other day when I was looking into piracy in the Adriatic. Like, I was curious about Albanian piracy, like whether under the Ottomans Albanians hassled Venetian shipping, and they did, it turns out. So I found on Google Books there's actually a monograph written about Venetian, like, espionage and counter espionage in the Adriatic Sea in the 1600s, but it was not translated from Italian. So I did find myself, like, looking at, like, the chapter headings and being like, oh yeah, I got the gist of this.
You could do what Lawrence did and get it translated and never read it.
Yeah, I did do that once. I asked the light. There was a radio play I had heard called Wildcats that was adapted from a German radio play called Wildkatzen. So I went to the UNM library and I'm just like, as a joke almost, hey, can you guys get me a copy of Wildkatzen, like the radio play? And they somehow got me a PDF transcript within 30 minutes, which, very strange.
Librarians are so fucking cool. Sorry, I don't want to toot my own horn, but what a great profession.
But the problem is that it was written in German, right?
Right.
And I speak a very small amount of German, but definitely not enough for a surrealist radio play about cats that might not exist. So I found a translator in our German department and paid her to translate it. And that was, 2011, and I still have not actually, maybe 2012. And I still have not actually read the translation.
I mean, just the thought that counts.
Yeah. you paid for that German student's, you know, fancy dinner. So
yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what you did is, for one thing, like, you gave this obscure German play a circ, right? Like, they're able to enter that in their statistics as, hey, someone sought this out, which is terrific. That just, you just upped its chances of preservation by 1,000,000%. That if anyone can say, like, in the last 10 years, someone asked for this.
Well, it was a PDF, though, so I don't know. Does circs matter for that?
The owning library, wherever they found it, the owner, because like a lot of times, like those, you'll have people. I actually went through an interlibrary loan to try to get a particular monograph about the late Permian terrestrial fauna from the 1960s, and our interlibrary loan librarian got back to me and was like, "Hey, there's just two libraries in the country that have this, and both of them want to charge you $50. Do you want to do that?" And I was like, "No, I don't want to pay $50." But she was like, "Hey, I can just get you a PDF." It's like, oh, word, okay. So yeah, now I have a cool PDF of a 60s paleontology book with all kinds of neat drawings in it.
Are you gonna actually read it? Because that was the step that, you know, brought me low.
I would say I can read it, but I also do not have enough anatomy, like skeletal anatomy vocabulary, to understand it.
Ah, that can be an issue.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, I was just in it for the cool pictures, you know.
So anyways, you were talking about Albanian pirates, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
but that's weird.
Well, that's weird. He's so offended.
I mean, he's not wrong.
Yeah, it was weird. I mean, the situation is that there is the ghost of a Neanderthal that shapeshifted into this girl's sister. Somehow it knew what
to
she
help
looked
her.
Like. To help her get out of the canyon.
He also makes this logical leap with basically no like guiding force here. She's just like, "I thought I saw my sister in the canyon." He's like, "It must have been a Sworth, a shape-shifting ghost." And it's like, why must it have been that? Are you sure she didn't just imagine it? Like, what other evidence do you have besides this one story that is very fantastical?
Yeah,
and then the effect of the Neanderthals turning invisible, except when you're trying to paint it, but you still can't see it. Just baffling, and possible even to explain in words somehow.
That's
like,
that's
what
one
that mean.
That's one. So there's my guess would be, okay. Here's how I would explain it. There was a phenomenon.
Well written.
Yeah, it's not very well written, but there's a in kind of occult circles, especially in like the 19th century and early 20th century, there was a mode of contacting the beyond called automatic writing, mm-hmm. where the conceit was that someone would have a pen and paper and they would just begin writing. They would empty their mind to be a channel for some other being. Wait. And then they would write what that being had to say. So perhaps she is a bit of automatic painting. Going on there, that she's able to contact, her unconscious mind is able to psychically sense the figure there, and so she paints it, but her conscious mind remains unaware.
Or maybe it's like that one Japanese movie, I can't remember what it's called, but where every time they take a picture, you can see the ghost on her, like she can see a ghost, but only through the camera.
Yeah.
But it's like that, but then, you know, they didn't have good instant cameras for this play, sure. So they just did it with painting.
So you had to wait for several hours while she sketched. Much less scary. Let's see.
Want to move on to low points?
Oh well, I did want to point out. I don't. This is more of an interesting thing than a high or a low point, but it is weird. Just this Neanderthal seems like pretty bro tier. Like, he helps her get out of the canyon, he makes her painting way better, and the only reason he murders that guy was because he's, like, robbed his tomb, which I'm
yeah.
kind of okay with.
Yeah. He does seem
involved.
Like it's a...
He gave
he's
him
a pretty
a warning.
Helpful dude.
Yeah, the guy specifically was warned.
Right, it's not like he moved it and then they figured out what it said. Like, he knew before it got moved, like, and he laughed it off. So, you know, I'm kind of on the caveman side.
Yeah.
The caveman must have been super evil to get cursed like that.
I think, nah, that's
no,
like...
he the laid of, the curse.
Yeah, that's like...
He wrote the curse for himself, yeah.
He wrote except the curse and then died?
Yeah, and then died from a broken neck.
that doesn't make any sense.
here's what happened. He wrote the curse and just carried the tablet around with him just in case he fell into a crevasse and broke his neck.
Yeah. Anytime he died, the tablet would fall out and then everyone
boom,
would...
Boom, and it's automatically in effect.
And then he'd get buried. Boom.
Because
it
was very
worth.
And I think, and you know what? I'm gonna say that the show sort of half just faintingly tied back to this, maybe, because when the anthropologist guy was explaining about how Neanderthals are, you know, actually pretty sophisticated, he said that there is evidence that they laid their dead to rest with great ceremony or something like that. So that I can see, like, perhaps, you know, funerary, the status of one's remains after death was very important to these Neanderthals. So that's why you carry around your curse tablet.
This actually could have been his headstone, because they did say he was buried, and or he was probably buried like far underground. And there was some kind of seismic.
Oh yeah, there was some kind of like a landslide brought it up or something. Yeah,
I mean, so that could have been his headstone or something.
If you think about it, rest in peace is almost a threat. Like, you know, rest in peace, or
or else you'll die if you don't. If you don't let me rest in peace, you will die the same way I did.
I like the, yeah. It would be very funny, like. So he gets buried, and then something happens, so his corpse gets dug up a few days later, and it gets scavenged. So then his ghost just has to wander around, like, breaking the heads of various, or necks of various prehistoric hyenas and coyotes and such. It's like, fucking buzzards, they fly. I don't know how I'm gonna do this.
Oh, man, but that would be a great paleontological puzzle if someone, you know, they start finding, like, yeah, like, coyote skeletons and all, like, you know, scattered around this canyon, and all their necks are broken.
And they call it Broken Neck Canyon, and they decide that it's the world, like, history's first serial killers, like, dumping ground, essentially. Yeah. Anyways, let's move on to low points. So my first one is that there is a brief point where she's hanging out in the canyon getting spooked, and they're playing what are supposed to be ominous bird noises, and they sound like a chicken that's, like, choking to death. And they're
fuck, man, that was my high point, actually. Hold up. So back in the day, Ronald, Lawrence, and I were eating at a cafeteria at UNM, and we noticed that Lawrence made sounds that were, like, really squeaky and, like, screechy and, like, duck-like. And this sound reminded me of that exact moment. Did you feel the same way?
I have no memory of this incident.
The only thing I remember is you constantly making duck noises at him. I don't actually remember the inciting incident.
Oh, yeah, I remember that period when you kept making duck noises at me. But I don't know if I ever knew why you were doing that, honestly.
Well, this reminded me of that, all right?
Okay, so your high point is that a comical noise in this horror radio play reminded you of something else from your life. You know what?
That no one else can relate to.
You know what? Fine.
Even the people who were there.
My high point, then, is that this reminded me of The Reddening by Adam Neville, which also concerns prehistoric fucked up shit in Britain. And I like that novel a lot. And you...
Well, that's a little bit more relatable, so I'm going to give it a thumbs down.
I mean, have any of you read
The Reddening? Is that your low point, Lawrence?
No, that's... Have any of you read The Reddening? Answer the question.
But it doesn't sound funny, though.
But I don't think anyone can ever experience the thing that Rahul said.
I'm not even convinced that Rahul experienced it, honestly. I think Rahul might have come up with this memory retroactively to explain why he kept making duck noises at me. He's like, why did I spend a year making duck noises at Lawrence? There must have been a reason. I can't just be a random asshole.
Surely.
How was that being an asshole? Oh, I can't make duck noises now.
Yeah.
This is wokeness run amok, Lawrence. You can't tell a man he can't make a duck noise.
Sorry, man. Yeah, man.
Canceled for duck noises.
A duck noise, but that's weird.
Oh, actually, there was a really great line in this where the dude was like, "You went up there to paint," and the other guy was like, "Of course she did." I don't know why that got me.
I think, you know, they just, like, didn't know how to do these, like, line reads.
I was like, this guy got kind of heated at that.
Yeah. Damn, man. Like, wasn't that big of a question.
Like, why was she there? Yeah.
Another low point I have, and this is, like, a serious one, I guess, is that at one point the main lady is trying to make a long distance call, and for some reason this involves rattling off 30 seconds of exposition to the operator. So she has to tell the operator her name, and then she It's like, oh, I'm calling from X. And then she's like, oh, yeah, that's right. The artist colony.
Yeah. Okay. There was a lot of stuff that... Here's some low points here. There's a lot of stuff that makes, like, no sense at the start of this.
You mean the part where the Neanderthal's ghost is also a shape changer?
Well, okay. You know, that's like, a part of the episode, I guess. You just have to accept it. But at the start, she says, like, oh, I just got cut off. I'm trying to reconnect. But then she goes on to say that her sister, she doesn't know where she was all day. And she thinks she was supposed to be in London, but like she saw her down in the canyon, so she's pretty convinced that she's at home. And so like it's like, well, were you just talking to her? I don't understand what you mean. And then also I thought, maybe I'm misremembering this, but I thought at one point she was like, when she finally did talk to her sister, she says something like, it wasn't her voice, I'm sure of it. And like then they figure out that it was her voice because it was a Neanderthal shape-shifting ghost that let her out of the canyon that turned into her sister. But it was like, well, why'd you say that thing about it not being her voice? Like, I thought her sister was dead or something. And
it really would have made a lot more sense for her sister to be dead. As it is, she appears to briefly think that her sister somehow teleported into a canyon, got bathed in otherworldly light, and then showed her a way out of the canyon before disappearing.
Well, to be fair, would you think that more reasonable than Neanderthal ghosts?
Yeah, you're right. There's no good solution to this.
Yeah, it's not like that one's a lot more reasonable. They're both pretty weird.
Yeah, I have a low point that I realized as we were talking.
Yeah.
Right now. And that's, have any of you guys seen the M. Night Shyamalan movie Lady in the Water?
I have not, but is this about the Snarfs?
It is. So in that movie, which is very stupid, there's like a, you know, there's the titular Lady in the Water. It's this woman who drops into a pool at an apartment complex where a bunch of people live, including an amazing screenwriter played by M. Night himself, and also a snooty critic played by Bob Balaban, who hates art and artists. Anyway, the whole thing is a very dumb movie, but one of the stupidest, most infuriating things about it is that everyone's trying to figure out what this mysterious, clearly magical woman is and is doing. And there's a Korean grandmother who lives in the apartments with her daughter who like translates for her. And she has heard from folklore about creatures called Narts that are like this woman and have these certain traits or whatever. And they keep like every time there's like a plot point with like something happening with the woman or whatever, they go back and ask the grandmother about it, and she's like, oh yeah, also Narts do this and that too. And then Narts do this. And it's just this stupid one, Nart, fuck off. and two, just the idea that there's one character who randomly knows all about this made up supernatural being who happens to be on site. That's exactly what that guy was doing with Swartz.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty much.
You just like need a dude to explain it to the audience. Otherwise,
well, I mean, so I'm not going to figure it out.
I mean, right, you aren't going to figure it out is the thing.
Yeah. Right, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, come on.
I would probably figure it out, but yeah, the average.
You know a lot about Swartz.
I didn't even need Dr. What's his name? Godolfo?
He doesn't know anything about Swartz. Gustav. He knows about Neanderthals.
Oh, right.
Yeah, he knows. Yeah, Gustav knows Neanderthals.
I mean,
he knows Neanderthals so well, he can sight read a stone tablet from 40,000 years ago. Hey, do you think that guy knows all about Swartz because he went to Swarthmore College?
He probably does.
Yeah, that's, I don't like know why. I know. Yeah, yeah.
A shape-shifting ghost.
That's a shape-shifting Neanderthal ghost who looks like your sister. Go shape-shifting ghosts who look like your sister. They'd say at the basketball games.
An 8-foot-tall version of your sister, I guess.
And she's glowing.
I think it was 8 feet tall.
Doesn't matter.
Does not matter. Does not matter. No.
Anyways. Another little point. The Neanderthal is named Banna, I think.
Name?
Yeah, he introduces himself.
Oh shit!
That's right. Yeah, when he's at the museum. Yeah.
Oh yeah, you're right. Yes. Yeah.
And he can speak English, but he still doesn't know his way around the building.
He can read English. He can read English because they like point out like, oh yeah, you got the black lettering on the door. And he's like, oh, of course, thank you. It's like. What the fuck?
Yeah. He's a very polite man. I mean, as a Swarth, he learned a lot. You know,
I guess so. He's just been there, like, you know, just kicking around that canyon for 40,000 years. You pick a few things up.
Maybe it's a Frankenstein sitch where there used to be like a blind, you know, hermit who lived in there and taught him his letters or something.
Yeah. Or I guess, you know, whatever kind of indigenous peoples were in that. Well, that's, I say indigenous peoples. I pictured this whole thing happening in the American West just because I hear the word canyon and that's what I think. But Lawrence, I think you helpfully pointed out as we were kind of talking about it in the chat that it is actually never explained where they are. But there's references to, like you said, like English places like London and, you know, and then of course there's the ambiguous mid-Atlantic accent. So
I kind of assumed it was in Europe.
Yeah, so either she's trying to long distance call London from America, which I don't know if that would have been possible in the 40s. I don't know when they laid that cable. Or it's set in London or like England, but no one's bothering to do accents. It's hard to know.
Yeah, that's a good question.
So I just did a quick Google search on canyons in England. One of the reasons why I think we were tripped up here is that they do not use the word canyon in England to describe landforms. That is a Spanish word, and we use it here because that's what the Spanish called all these landforms in the American West when they were, you know, discovering and genociding. But it does look like England does have a few gorges. So I think maybe if they had said, you know, we went down into the gorge, that would have passed a little better for old Blighty.
So whatever, you know, they're doing, they're not doing it well, is the thing.
I googled it, and the first telephone circuit open for public correspondence was opened in 1926/27. So
for transatlantic, between New York and London.
Because they laid that transatlantic telegraph cable. You know, they had this big meaty copper cable across the ocean, and they hooked it up to the telephone system.
So I guess it could be England or America. We'll never know. I think the circumstantial evidence points slightly more towards England. But on the other hand, it's not conclusive. Anyways, Dan, you actually said you had something about how there could be Neanderthals in North America, which would otherwise be weird for that possibly.
It's
be the
weird. No, this is actually a weird recently discovered site. I'll call it a site because to call it an archaeological site would be making a claim that some people dispute. As it's typically like the peopling of the Americas, like when human beings first came to the Americas, has been kind of in flux in recent decades, with a lot of interesting finds pushing that date back. Is it typically had been assumed that it was like after the last glaciation subsided, so around 10,000 years ago is when modern Homo sapiens people came and peopled the Americas. But that's started to be pushed back to as far back as like 30,000 years ago with certain sites. It's very exciting, very interesting. But the whole consensus had been that, like, well, no hominids ever made it to the Americas before Homo sapiens. So with hominids like Homo erectus, Neanderthals, hominids like that, they were actually all over Eurasia and Africa. Like you had them, like they had expanded out, you know, into these places. But we presumed that they never made it to the Americas. But in 2017, a paper was published on a particular site in San Diego County. So like nearby and actually like a huge like metro area. It's referred to as the Cerruti Mastodon site. It was a site with some mastodon remains, which have features on the bones that are consistent with other mastodon hunt sites known from the old world that were like really old, like Paleolithic hunt sites. So that would have been like Homo erectus or Homo Neanderthalus, right? Neanderthalensis, rather. Now, what makes this very interesting is that they did dating on these remains. They did dating on the remains themselves. They did dating on the layers of soil on either side of the remains. And it's pretty rock solidly dated to 130,000 years ago.
Ah.
So and this is a big if the trauma to those mastodon bones really did come, and they found like some big like cobblestones nearby the site associated with the remains that look a lot like the kind of big stones that very early tool using people would have carried around with them to bash stuff. You know, like you kind of walked around with some nice bashing rocks just in case you needed them. Like that was your utility belt. So if these are being interpreted correctly, that not only pushes back when humans or human-like beings first came to the Americas 100,000 years earlier than our earliest dates that we have now, it also means that non-Homo sapiens, archaic humans, got there at some point, which would be really exciting and would really, because that's the first evidence, even potential evidence, of a scientific standard that has been found to indicate that. So that was when I was listening, that's what I was thinking about, because I thought this was happening in California. Anyway, so that was a neat thing that I was reminded of listening to this very stupid radio play.
Were there also Neanderthals in England? I know there were other hominids there, but yeah. I don't know if Neanderthals got there.
Yeah, Neanderthals made it to England. I think at the time, at the kind of the heyday of Neanderthals, England was mostly glaciated. So it's not like it was like a big time place for Neanderthals the way that kind of the ancient Near East and Southern Europe was. So like really most of your Neanderthal find sites are in what's today Syria and Palestine and Israel and Spain, Italy. There's a couple in there's a lot in the Caucasus as well, like Georgia, Armenia, places like that. But I think there has been evidence of Neanderthals in England, or at the very least, as far as our contemporary scientific well-established understanding, the story makes way more sense in England than the United States.
I mean, except for, again,
whatever sense it's going to make. Yeah, the 8 feet tall thing was really odd. I don't know if that was like tying in giant lore to all this, or if it's like a matter of, but it just still seems really weird. Like if you knew enough about Neanderthal research to put words in your scientist character's mouth about how sophisticated they were, that are pretty accurate to what science's understanding was at the time, then you would also have known that they weren't 8 feet tall.
I mean, he literally name checks their tool making culture. And as far, if I remember my anthropology class correctly, he got it right.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually like, that's a pretty good rundown, except for the gobsmacking weirdness of it being, it's weird. They weren't 8 feet tall.
And also they didn't have writing as far as we know. Again, they totally might have, it just didn't survive, but
I mean, there could have been something like the Kipu, if you guys know about the Andean system of record keeping with tying knots and leather straps. Mm-hmm. That there was so that there's all kinds of ways to encode information in materials that just do not survive archaeologically. So I would not be surprised at all if Neanderthals did have some sort of symbolic encoding system that just birch bark or something for it, you know?
And honestly, like, if you saw it, you could read it.
Yeah, definitely.
and if you put that in front of me, I can just really, it is no problem. That my old high school Neanderthal classes, yeah, you know, really kicked in. I remember my vocabulary lists.
We use the same exact system.
The idea might be that if it's a purely pictographic, you know, like a kind of writing system, then technically, kind of like how Chinese is all ideograms, so that technically you can write any language in Chinese ideograms because each symbol represents an idea rather than a specific sound.
Yeah.
But I mean, so the thing is that they've got ideas that it doesn't seem like you could really encode representationally. Like, for
instance, yeah,
a curse. Easy.
Or being killed in the same way that I was killed. Yeah. I don't know. Does anyone else have anything to say about this shit?
I don't know.
It was a weird one. Yeah.
Despite all of it, I thought it was still like all right. You know, I don't know why.
I liked
the phone thing a lot. Like, just like being taken back to how challenging an international call would be. You know, like waiting on the operator. My God,
I meant to tell the operator where your name, who you're calling, how they're related to you, where you what kind of place that place work. Is.
Well, it reminded me of I don't know if this is true, but like I've read a story where like there was I believe it was in Ireland where the postman managed to actually locate someone, but their address was written on it as like, this is going out to Seamus, who is Mary's boy. Last I knew, they lived in Ballymote, but someone there might be able to tell you where he is now. They eventually found the guy and delivered the letter.
You know what? Wow. God bless the Irish postal system. The boys in green, I assume, because I'm racist a little.
Right. I mean, that's every uniform over there is green all the way down. Yeah.
One quick point about the episode before we leave it. The real reason I did not recommend this episode, and we didn't really talk about this, the audio quality on this is horrible.
It's
pretty bad.
It's probably the worst episode in terms of audio quality that we've listened to on this show. There was parts of it where I was like, I don't even know if I'm going to finish this. This is like so bad. Grating on the ears.
Did you listen to the YouTube?
Yes.
Okay.
I did my best on this one, but no one's bothered cleaning this show up because it's not beloved the way Quiet Please is.
I'm not saying it's your fault. I clearly just the recording got messed up. But man,
I mean, it is kind of astonishing really that we have it at all. People were not in the habit of saving recordings at this time.
Yeah. 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 I guess I'm glad that, it survived in some way, shape or form, but the audio quality here is really bad. So FYI, another low point. Anyways, we can move on.
Yeah, maybe the bird sound that I'm in love with was just like a recording artifact.
That was an artifact.
she comments on it. So what was the original bird sound?
It was just like chirp, chirp.
Turning in like. Rah, rah, rah.
You know, now
like, wow, that sounds like Lawrence.
My God, that's Lawrence. Sounds like a tape being torn out of a tape player.
It sounds like the noise Cookie Monster makes when he's pretending to eat cookies. That's the trick of Cookie Monster, incidentally. Watch carefully. He never actually eats a cookie.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
He just mashes them into pieces and then they fall down as the front of him.
Yeah. Shockingly, he's a puppet and doesn't actually have a throat.
Yeah, we're blowing the lid off all kinds of things right now.
Spoilers for the listener, by the way.
That reminds that's not my joke. It's an American Dad joke where for some reason he's getting very angry at PBS and he's shouting, "Don't trust Cookie Monster. He never eats the cookies. He just mashes them around."
It's good. Anyway, it's good.
It's a good joke. Anyways, let's I got a game.
All right.
And this game is a very simple game where I ask you a question, you answer it, and there are no points, and you're like, how is that a game? And I'm like, shut the fuck up, nerd. So
it's just a question.
Yeah. Anyways, what was the first movie you remember seeing in theaters? Rahul, you first.
Oh, wow. That I remember seeing in theaters would have to be Titanic.
What was, do you remember anything about your viewing experience or perhaps your erotic awakening seeing?
No, and I choose not to delve into that now.
Titanic was definitely the first boob I saw.
Yeah. Well, I've seen it, mother's as well, I would imagine.
Well, yeah. Okay. First boob I've seen it referred to as a generation defining boob.
Yeah.
That's good, man.
You know, we all saw it. We all knew about it.
We all know where we were.
Yeah.
Yeah. Walk down the street. You know, you make eye contact with somebody. You nod. You know what they're thinking.
My main Titanic memories are: it came out when I was in like kindergarten or first grade, and the two things I remember most were I did not understand what was going on in the car scene. Obviously, so I'm just like, man, it must be really unpleasant being in that fucking car if it's that like hot and steamy in there. And then the other one was getting very jealous of Leonardo DiCaprio because all the girls in my like kindergarten class thought that he was dreamy.
Oh yeah,
we weren't that young.
It came out in like 95, dude.
Wait, Titanic? Young.
Yeah,
Titanic was 1998.
Oh, 98. Okay. Then I guess I was in third grade, and it makes a little more sense that I was jealous.
I know that because unlike you guys, I am an ancient man, and I was well into high school when it came out.
Oh man, you knew what was going on in the car.
You've seen plenty of boobs by then.
I wouldn't say I'd seen plenty, but I will say that I had seen my parents' VHS copy of Excalibur a few times.
Oh yeah, that's a classic rewind. Why is the tape so worn out in this one spot?
I don't even know what that is. I'm gonna have to figure that one out.
Oh man, you're missing. You know that band I like, Anul Nathrak? Their name comes from a thing that Merlin says in that movie.
Yeah. Cool. My dad used to be able to recite the full charm of making.
Yeah.
As like a little, I guess a little parlor trick that he would do. Yeah. Yeah.
And it also has a ton of nudity of very attractive British actresses from like the 80s.
Yeah, Excalibur rules, and not just for those reasons.
Yeah, it's also like got like good filmmaking and stuff. John Boorman,
yeah,
excellent filmmaker.
Indeed. Also,
was the car scene the one where he's like, "I live my life a quarter mile." was that the one we're talking about? Titanic.
Yes. That is.
I'll tell you what. If the family had been there, that ship wouldn't have sunk.
Yeah. Maybe it would have because they have a bad.
Or maybe they're pretty destructive. Yeah,
wouldn't have made it out of port. It would have just like driven out of with it. The ship.
If the family had been there, there would not have been shots of people drowning, no matter what happened. Because either they
that's right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You wouldn't have cared. One of the two.
Yeah.
They're not.
They would have all died inside the ship when it exploded.
I mean, like, when they're dragging that mace through Bogota, Colombia, or safe through Bogota, Colombia, and just wrecking the city, you don't see, like, whose lives they're destroying.
All the people are like, somebody has to fix the roads now.
You probably killed, realistically, like, 20 people doing this and destroyed 3 buildings.
That's one thing I really respected about Speed 2 is that they showed all the fucking people that they killed with by like steering the boat into port.
But the guy kept doing wisecracks while it was happening, which was very strange.
it was like the movie knew that this guy was an evil piece of crap and it wanted to show us.
But also he kept telling jokes. I guess maybe it might be not trying to show us that he was a psychopath. Anyways. But
he was just a random side character who was comic relief, so it's kind of up for debate. Yeah,
I don't think that movie was smart enough to know that was what it was doing.
No, it definitely was
I think
not.
It just thought that boats exploding was cool.
Yeah,
and it was right.
It was right. That was the coolest part of the movie.
Anyways, Dan, what was the first movie you saw in theaters?
Yeah, so I kind of have two answers here. I know that the first movie that my parents ever took me to see was Batteries Not Included from 1987. Y'all familiar with this one?
That's a classic. Yeah, Tobar.
So it's a movie about, there's like little flying saucer aliens, but they're like about the size of like, you know, fit in the palm of your hand, who come to Earth and end up living with some family who runs like a diner or something like that. I have not seen it, you know, in 35 years, and I was a child, a very young child, so I do have recollections of like the little
saucer,
the little saucer guys, like the stop motion of the saucers. I do have memory of that. The first movie that I have real true recollection of, having gone and seen and gotten a lot out of, is UHF.
Hell yeah.
My parents took me, I don't know if it was opening weekend because, you know, famously it opened against Tim Burton's Batman. So box office was not particularly great, but I did see it in the theater and it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen in my entire life. I loved it. So I would have been, let's see, that was 1990. So I would have been, I would have been like 7 years old.
Hell yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And Ronald, what's the first movie you remember seeing in theaters?
In theaters is really hard. I'm pretty sure I saw Batman in theaters, which...
Wait, Batman 89?
Well, I was a baby.
Maybe Batman Returns?
No, I didn't. I don't remember seeing it, but I'm pretty sure that my parents took me to that one.
Chaos energy taking an infant to that film, I feel.
Apparently, I was pretty okay. No, but I think this isn't a theater movie, but the first movie I remember ever seeing is a movie called Cat's Eye.
Wait, that Stephen King anthology movie?
Yes. the one where a cat fights a goblin.
And
yes.
Also, like, doesn't, what's his face, that famous Hollywood tough guy who was in Reservoir Dogs, Lawrence Tierney, doesn't he threaten to rape a woman at one point in that to make a guy stop smoking?
I'm not going to lie. I don't remember the movie that well because I was pretty young when I watched it. I just
would not have seen that film.
You're telling me that a Stephen King story had like a weird sex hangup over a substance abuse problem?
Right.
That doesn't sound like him.
Shocking. No, my sister was really into it and she was a lot older. And so I ended up watching a lot of weird horror movies with her growing up.
Hell yeah.
And that's like probably the first movie I ever remember watching.
One sec, I want to see if Lawrence Tierney actually is in Cat's Eye. Because it's bugging me.
I know it has... I
don't know who the threatening guy is. I guess it might not be Lawrence Tierney, but it's some like really old, like terrifying Hollywood actor, I think.
Gotcha. I know it has the guy from Airplane.
Vinny Donati. One sec. This is great rate fucking rating.
Right, yeah. Apparently. Just Lawrence Googling actor names.
And no, it's Alan King who does the threatening, not Lawrence Tierney.
Ah.
Still legendary, pretty like I guess he's not quite as like the same sort of guy as Lawrence Tierney, but he's you know.
He was in Rush Hour.
Yeah, and Casino, I think. Yeah, he plays Andy Stone in Casino. Anyways, moving on.
I think it's your turn.
Yeah, so the first movie I ever saw in theaters was Rock-A-Doodle-Doo, which is a movie it's an adaptation of a French play called Chanticleer about the war between pessimism and optimism and the role of the artist in the world, which the movie expresses by having a rooster that is also Elvis somehow.
Yeah, that's a Don Bluth joint.
Yes, and it's even less well conceived than most of his like projects in the early 90s.
Even more of a bizarre project than The Pebble and the Penguin, perhaps.
Yeah, or A Gnome in Central Park, I want to say.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, anyways, and the main thing I remember about it was that I was terrified of it. Just absolutely fucking terrified. the whole movie. Yeah, I think I saw it when I was like 3 or something, and the whole like big moving image in a dark room thing was not something I was on board with.
Yeah.
The first time I can remember having a good time at the movies was when I saw Jurassic Park in theaters, which I very much enjoyed. Although my grandfather, who took me later, told me that he was very disappointed in it because he had expected it to be a sober discussion of the evolution of dinosaurs. And instead he got,
oh my God, can I talk to your grandpa?
He, I mean, when you go to heaven? Yes.
Well, if he's a swarf, I can do it.
Oh yeah. Shift into a dinosaur to talk.
I feel very strongly a kinship with this man because I too, let me tell you, I was a big dinosaur. It's just very big fucking surprise. I was a big dinosaur kid.
You're a big dinosaur adult. So
yeah. To prepare for the film coming out, I had my mom order me a copy of Jurassic Park out of, do you remember you used to get like a catalog of books?
Oh yeah.
In the mail. Like it was like the Columbia Record Club, but for books.
Yeah.
And so I read Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park at age nine to make sure that when I watched the movie, I would be able to adequately compare it to the source material.
Oh yeah.
And, I remember mostly, of course, I was blown away. You know, I there was a lot of stuff that in the book that didn't make it to the movie that I was a little disappointed about. But all in all, like, okay, word, this is really great. This is cool. One thing that really stuck in my craw, and it sticks in my craw to this day. So you know the scene where they're showing the kids around, they're having the tour, and there's the big herd of like ostrichy looking dinosaurs,
running at them. The Gallimimuses?
The Gallimimuses, yeah. And so the kid is looking, you know, the little dinosaur nerd kid. Is looking at me like, oh, that's a Gallimimus. Because you couldn't remember the mimus part? Mm-hmm. Fuck you. That is not the part you wouldn't remember. Almost every dinosaur in that clade is called something mimus. The first dinosaur discovered from that group was called Ornithomimus, ostrich mimic. And so they would name them like Struthiomimus, Gallimimus. That's, you know, swan mimic, duck mimic, you know, whatever. Like that's every single dinosaur that looks like that would be called the something mimus. The part you're not going to remember would be the other part, the prefix, not the suffix.
So star of Star Kid and Jurassic Park, you've been called out by Dan.
You've been called out. It's basically, it's like not remembering the Saurus part of Stegosaurus.
Yeah.
It's an insane thing to write.
It's just an irrecoverable error, frankly. Yeah.
I was jerked out of my suspension of
disbelief. You were ready to walk out.
Man.
I was furious. I boycotted Tiny Toon Adventures because I wanted nothing to do with Steven Spielberg.
Boy, I sure hope somebody got fired for that blunder.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
One other thing. This doubles back to the episode, but I just want to say, so this woman literally got photobombed by a Neanderthal. Like, that is what happened.
That is what happened, yeah.
Let's do recommendations and cautions. What do you guys think?
Let's do it.
Sure.
Okay. Do it. Dan, would you like to go first?
I think Dan's going to caution his Jurassic Park.
Big caution, red flags with Jurassic Park. They started adding little feathers onto the dromaeosaurids nowadays, but it's not enough.
The velociraptors are too big, and also they seem too mean. They probably wouldn't be that ferocious all the time, only when they're hungry. Total
That's
bullshit.
Exactly right.
We're going to shut
That's
the whole
exactly
thing
right.
down.
The whole thing, I've had it with the whole thing. So caution, Jurassic Park. Don't go see it if you haven't seen it.
You know what? I'm going to totally sidetrack us. There is a novel called Anonymous Rex, where the principal, like, theory of the novel, if you will, is that dinosaurs survived the extinction and now exist among us in very elaborate human suits after having bred themselves smaller and slightly more bipedal looking.
Wow.
And the main character in it is a velociraptor named Vincent. And at one point he watches Jurassic Park and gets very offended with how they have done velociraptors dirty in the movie.
that's pretty good. That's kind of the conceit behind the Super Mario Brothers movie, too.
Very possible he was inspired. And also the novel features a lot of explicit and weird sex scenes that I'm worried have distorted my sexuality to this day because I read it when I was far too young.
Apparently there's a movie.
Yeah, you know, I read the famous paleontologist and personal hero of mine, Robert Backer, wrote a novel from the perspective of a Utah raptor.
I have read that novel, Raptor Red.
Raptor Red, yes. And I will say I was embarrassed and probably blushed during the mating dance scenes.
The main thing I remember is that at one point he takes a completely gratuitous swipe at rap music when he is describing a cacophony that is hard to discern, and he's just like, it's like modern day rap music but written with shit because it's like describing the smell. So that the
boy, that's really Bob, you gotta do better, buddy.
I mean, it was the early 90s before we knew what was going to happen with the rap musics, I think. But
yeah, it was the early 90s, and that was like the easiest joke in the world to make. Yeah. Am I still on? I'm on my recommendations. I've only cautioned people.
Also,
before
you go, Ronald, that movie, it stars Isaac Hayes, but it isn't very good because the dinosaurs use, first of all, they adapt the second book, not the first one, which I think is a mistake when you're kicking off a series. And second, instead of having the dinosaurs in elaborate suits, they instead have them use holograph technology, which is much less funny and therefore less good.
Yeah, that's terrible.
It is much funnier to imagine they're stuffed into a suit.
Yeah. Anyways, sorry, Dan, do your recommendation. Enough of Lawrence's weird sex books from when he was little.
Yeah, well, I was going to recommend Lawrence's weird sex books.
Yeah.
We'll
get to those in Lawrence's recommendations.
Yeah, I was going to recommend, and I had Lawrence go back to the tape for me to make sure I had not recommended them before. Apparently, I've talked about it before, but y'all, it is Tangelo season, and they are so good. Please visit your produce section of your local grocery store. Look for Tangelos. That's a seasonal citrus. Now is the time. Winter is the time for citrus. So we're kind of getting out of the season right now. So please go buy some Tangelos if you haven't already. Everyone I've had this year has been a banger. I'm going crazy for them, as I always do. The last time I went to go get some, it was like $2 off for a 3-pound bag.
Hell yeah.
That's a great deal. So, be on the lookout at your local Publix for some kind of deals like that. Tangelos. I swear to God, navel oranges, get out of my sight. Valencia, I don't want to have anything to do with you. All right. Give me them Tangelos. They're terrific.
And do you have a caution as well?
Jurassic Park.
The movie, the book, the media property, the any of the many video games. What are we talking?
Itself.
Yeah, the minus line.
Yeah, I would caution you against going to a for-profit dinosaur park. They're going to be cutting corners. If we're going to do this right, it's going to have to be under the custodianship of some sort of like more publicly oriented, scientifically oriented institution like the Smithsonian or something.
Let's be real, Dan. If the only park there was that had dinosaurs was for a profit, you would go.
I would go, and I would write a big Twitter thread about how, as a socialist, I felt very conflicted.
Guys, I want to try something. We cannot allow the corporations to socialize the risk of dinosaur parks while privatizing the profit of dinosaur parks. That was me attempting to do a Bernie Sanders. I don't think I pulled
that's
it off.
That's pretty good.
Oh, is that what that was?
Yeah, the fact that I played it afterwards did not really help. Yeah. And the fact that I kept stumbling.
If you could see him waggling his finger, you would have gotten it.
Yeah. You had the rhythm. I think you had the rhythm. That was good.
I had the rhythm, but not the tone, which is famously what you want to be with it. Anyways, I'm going to go next.
Yeah, you go next.
So
recommend some sex books from your childhood.
I am actually I'm cautioning against a sex book, weirdly. So first of all, my recommendation is Cold Moon Over Babylon by Michael McDowell. This is, I believe, a horror novel from 1979. It was adapted into a movie that I have not seen but looks bad, so you can get an audiobook of it. The basic plot is that there's a small town in the Florida panhandle called Babylon, where a family called the Larkins are maintaining a failing blueberry farm and a decrepit sort of house. And their daughter of the family has something horrible happen to her and die. And then tragedy keeps compounding on tragedy. And it looks like there's never going to be justice for them. But meanwhile, spooky, spooky things start happening in the town, particularly to the person who did or who caused the tragedy. And, you know, it goes from there. It's a Southern Gothic. Well, kind of, I guess. It's set in the South and it's got Gothic elements, but it isn't quite as like, I'm going to hit the Gothic tropes the way a lot of neo-Gothics do these days. Thing I liked best about it was, one, the writing style is beautiful. Two, incredibly effective characterizations. You generally know everything you need to know about a character within like two or three sentences of meeting them. And three, some of the horror effects, especially in the early sections, are very, very creepy and affecting. There's one scene, like the ultimate tragedy of the Larkins happens, in particular, that I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened. The only like thing I have against it, which isn't really a knock on it exactly, is that the ultimate like supernatural intervention that happens is pretty standard. And it was kind of disappointing, especially after it kept hinting at something way weirder. It ends up going to a place that has been done like a million times after seeming like it's going to do something stranger. So, you know, but it's still a really good time. Flew by like a breeze, and I really, really recommend it. And my caution is a book called Paladin's Hope by T. Kingfisher. This is the third book in her Paladins or her Saint of Steel series. And goddamn, I gave her like a break of almost a year between novels before going back to this, because I'd started like seeing the holes in the formula. And this is, it's just like, there's two dudes, you know that they're going to hook up. They get put in like a death maze, and the death maze is a little bit interesting, but they spend all their time moping about how no one could ever love them and how they have to break up with the other dude or not be with him for his own safety. And it's like, I know you guys are going to end up together. And this is just so boring. Plus, at least one of the dudes has no reason on God's green earth why he couldn't be loved. So he's just wallowing in self-loathing for no reason, which may be realistic for how people act, but especially when she's written two novels with that are like that before, just so boring. And
wow, like, that's like the exact same plot as Wild Wild West.
They get put in a debt. I mean, but did the dudes actually end up together at the end of Wild Wild West?
I think you're conflating Wild Wild West with the other big Kevin Kline comedy of that era, In and Out.
Does that have a death maze? Man, I gotta watch some fucking Kevin Kline movies.
There are sequels. Yeah.
Wild Wild West 2, The Maze of Death and the Gay Sex.
Well, there is a death maze in Wild Wild West.
Fair enough. But it also, like, the two dudes do end up having, not as explicit as she wrote the straight sex in the previous scenes, but still kind of explicit gay sex with each other.
They get to second base in Wild Wild West.
Yeah, but one of them's dressed in drag at the time, and they're, like, comparing boobs, right?
What a cool movie.
It's a pretty standard homophobic 90s
Yeah, that's
joke.
That's 1999, brother.
Yeah,
that's,
where Selma Hayek walks in and they're like, oh my God, she might think that we're a little bit like expressive in our genders. And yeah. It's the worst thing you can imagine. And then you see Selma Hayek's butt. Anyways.
All right.
Which
so let's go watch that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes it all
worth it. Selma Hayek nude? That's a rare thing. I mean, yeah. She did a fair amount of nudity in her heyday. Anyways, moving on. Enough of my pervasoidness. Rahul, what do you got for us?
All right. Well, I only watched the newest Netflix shows because I'm super basic. So, Shadow and Bone Season 2, terrible. I don't even want to go into why, but it's just pathetic. It's just pathetic.
I don't know why, but describing a show as just pathetic and refusing to explain further is so funny to me.
All right, I'll go into
very
it.
Rahul.
No, it's fine if you don't want to. I just think it's funny.
You watch it and you'll understand. It's fucking pathetic.
But you just told me not to watch it.
Well, you know.
Well, only watch it if you want to understand.
Anyway, so I feel like after watching this show, I feel like Netflix has an unnatural amount of like deathmatch anime shows.
Yeah, no shit.
I don't know why they have so many. They have Baki, they have Record of Ragnarok, and they have this one, Kengan Ashura.
Oh yeah.
Good old Kengan Ashura.
Those ones aren't deathmatches. Those are like non-death matches.
Kengan Ashura is a death match. I mean, it's basically a death match.
Well, I've only seen like the first few fights in it, but they are not death matches. Nobody dies.
It escalates.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, whatever. They have this formula where people just get pushed together. There's a big competition and people get pushed together and they have anime fights. So it's like...
That sounds like every anime almost. Except for the ones where the school kid ends up with a harem.
So that's most of them actually. Yeah. So this one's not like that.
That's every isekai.
Anyway, yeah, I mean, this is like a kids show. I feel almost, but for some
reason, sure.
A kids show with death matches.
You know, kids
what
grow
the
fast
fuck
these
do you
days.
Show kids?
This is America,
dude. I think you mean teenagers.
They're like, hey kids, it's time for you to learn about the birds and the bees, and then you show them Sallow.
Sallow?
Look it up.
It doesn't matter.
We won't get into it.
Anyway, yeah, so
it's a movie about
that.
How fascism is bad.
Okay.
You recommend Kengan Ashura?
Yeah.
Okay,
it.
Cool. All right,
and I can't wait to go to my neighborhood Publix and pick up some.
God damn.
Yeah, man. Get some sweet, sweet candles.
Hey, are you going to try to make it a sex fruit or... Because you said Publix.
I think he just wanted to say Publix. I'm not going to lie. I don't think that there was any more to it than that.
It's so good.
He heard something that could be slightly misconstrued as a grosser word.
I'm now trying to think of a sex version of Tangelo.
Oh, I mean, it's already kind of sexy sounding, you know, a Tangelo. It's got
yeah,
that kind
is.
Of, yeah,
Tangelo.
I think
yeah,
it's
can...
very, I think Rahul is very, like, so Publix is renowned for their, like, hoagies. Like, they have a really good deli, and you can get a good sandwich there. So I like saying, like, oh, if you want a good sandwich, go to Publix. just the image it concocts instantly.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah. Anyways, Okay, great. Publix. That's like the Crypt Keeper's younger, hornier brother. Like, trying to make a pun. The Sex Keeper. There.
There it is.
Anyways, let's get to some plugs and bring this on home. So, Dan, you have real things to plug, of course.
Yeah, so of course, the listeners to the show know that I always talk about the Cannonball, which is a again on a sporadically released these days. But of course, we have a nice big back catalog for everyone to explore, available wherever you get your podcasts. Also coming up, we have on Thronderdome, the world's only Star Wars podcast, but it might be the only one fully devoted to Star Wars novels, though. So we do have that going for us. But we are about to start season two. We actually just recorded our first episode of season two. So we have finished the first book in the Thrawn trilogy, Heir to the Empire. We're moving on to Dark Force Rising, which is a terrible title. But we'll see how Timothy Zahn does.
That could be any Star Wars book.
It could be anything. It's so dumb. Dude, like, yeah. So when we're doing Heir to the Empire, there was a 20th anniversary edition with author notes. Which was a gold mine for the show.
One of the most incredible finds in the history of podcasting. Yeah. Realizing that existed and what it could teach you about the mind of Timothy Zahn.
Yes. And here's something about the mind of Timothy Zahn. So Dark Force Rising is not a good title. The titles he wanted for Heir to the Empire, he wanted to call it The Warlord's Gambit.
What the fuck? Terrible. God.
He wanted the official continuation of the Star Wars saga, the first foot out the door, hardcover. It's really happening. The official sequel to Return of the Jedi, The Warlord's Gambit.
I mean,
and it was his editor who saved his ass with that one. It was like, no, we're not doing that. We're not doing that, Tim. It's gonna
be. I guess
he
was trying to get the Tom Clancy market by writing a book with a novel or a title that could be confused with a Tom Clancy.
It was just, I about fell out of my chair. But anyway, so that's, yeah. So The Cannonball and Thronderdome, two great podcast audio products. Great for at home, in the car, on the job, wherever you happen to be. Come listen to me yak.
Yeah. And Rahul, do you have a joke plug?
Yeah. This time I want to plug shark eggs. Have you ever seen them?
No.
Dude.
Shark eggs.
They're fucking crazy.
They're fucked up. Yeah.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
They are amazing. I'm
like, what the fuck?
Egg, yo? Like,
it looks like one of those fucking like face crabs from Half-Life.
They're all weird. It really does. It's incredible. It's amazing. And you can, some look like pine cones. Some look like, I don't know how this is an egg, but it's an egg.
No shark has ever laid a normal egg.
That is the shark guarantee. No normal eggs.
Why do they look like this?
I don't know.
Evolution.
But isn't it? It's incredible. Like, I kind of want one, you know? I don't. Can you crack it? I don't know what I'm looking at. Like,
yeah, they'll wash up occasionally. I believe that there's a kind of colloquial term for them, mermaid's purses. So you have the shark hatches and gets out of there and it kind of, you know, gets loose and you find it on the beach. It's a mermaid's purse.
Yeah, I'm not calling it that. I don't know.
Yeah. That makes it worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the weirdest thing ever.
Truly horrifying.
Jesus Christ. Well, anyways, from all of us at Bad Time Radio, don't worship Satan. It's bad for you. Have a great week.
If you'd like to recommend an episode of Old Time Radio for us to listen to, send us a question for the mailbag, or a pedantic correction, you can reach us at radiobadtime@gmail.com. Our theme music is Finger in the Bottle by We Ashore Dedicated off their album No Ski Here Okie Sap. Thanks so much for listening.
Well, I was gonna gather